Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Oh, Dad, come look, squealed six-year-old Ellen, running in from the yard. A baby bird is lying on the ground and only one wing is moving. Grabbing her father's hand, Ellen steered him out the door and over to her discovery, a tiny sparrow peeping pitifully and wiggling a single wing. He's so sad and lonely, Dad, Ellen pleaded. Can't we keep him? He can live in my night table drawer. She bent down to pick up the baby bird. From a parent's perspective, what should we teach our children about interacting with wildlife? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today we have just the guest Ellen's dad needed at that moment in the story. Chris Montori is the founder and director of Second Chance Wildlife Center in Gaithersburg, Maryland, outside Washington, D.C. She has both federal and state permits to rehabilitate wildlife. She works with many volunteers and young interns to save the lives of injured animals who are found in the wild. She also has a grown daughter and a young grandson. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's the most important thing we should do if our child finds an injured wild animal?
Well, I think one of the important things is to show the child that you're concerned as well. We want to help children develop compassion and respect for all living things. So you don't want to dismiss what they find and just say, well, that's nature's way. A child is not going to want to hear that. They want to take care of this animal. The next thing you want to do is remind the child that it's a wild animal. And just as their home is a lovely house in town and they enjoy living there, the wild animal enjoys living in the wild, is not going to be happy being kept as a pet. A wild animal needs to know it's wild, needs to be able to survive in the wild, because that's where it belongs.
What's the greatest danger for children who find wildlife that's either injured or too unafraid of people?
Well, the greatest danger is that the child could, in fact, be seriously injured. A number of wild animals have very efficient weapons. And what children don't understand, and they're feeling all this compassion, oh, poor little thing, just like seeing a little kitty and wanting to scoop it up and hold it. A wild animal has no idea that we're attempting to help. As far as they're concerned, they're about to become somebody's meal, and they will use all their weapons to the best of their ability to protect themselves. If a child reaches down and tries to scoop up the wrong animal, they're going to be hurt. The result is that the child is going to be raced off to a doctor or emergency clinic or something, and the animal is still going to be laying there needing help. So children should be cautioned not to touch these things. The first thing they need to do is go get mom or dad or an adult neighbor, somebody who has the maturity and the judgment to determine how best to deal with the animal.
Okay, now they've come and they've found us. They found this cute little animal, and they found us. And how can we then handle the situation?
Well, then it starts getting a little bit complicated. If, in fact, the animal needs help, then the best thing to do is first to think what you're doing. Again, people's hearts often lead their actions, and they will jump in and do something that they then regret. The first thing the adult wants to do is come up with an appropriate container. And I would caution people, no matter what the animal looks like, get a container with a lid. Animals often seem relatively comatose. They have a nasty habit of waking up in the car halfway to a rehabilitation center. Don't want that to happen. Get a container with a lid. Put an appropriate material in the bottom. Best idea, something like an old T-shirt, paper towels. Avoid green grass. People often put green grass in thinking, well, this is kind of nature. It'll help calm them down. Problem with green grass is it's cold and it's damp. Not something you want to put an injured animal on. Once you've got your container all ready, simplest thing to do is get yourself a towel, hand towel, bath towel, something of that sort. drop it over the animal, and gently gather up animal and towel, put it in the container, get the top on it, and don't mess with it any further. At that point, you can go in and call a rehabilitator or a rehab center and arrange to get the animal to them.
What about holes in the top of the box?
Well, you can put holes in the top of the box or the side of the box. One should remember that a cardboard box is not what you would call airtight. The animal is not going to suffocate. The holes are mainly for ventilation. So it would kind of depend. If it's a very hot summer and you're going to be in a car and there's no air conditioning, yeah, you probably want some holes in that box so the animal doesn't just roast. If it's during the winter, it's probably not as crucial.
Can you put an animal into a bucket or that kind of a container?
You can. In a pinch, you can use pretty much anything. We've had animals arrive in all sorts of contrivances, backpacks and socks and paper bags. Paper bags actually work just fine. A paper grocery bag with a flat bottom works just fine. You can put paper towels in the bottom, plop the animal in, and fold the top over. You've got it nicely contained. Now, obviously, that would not do for something like an adult squirrel that's going to tear the bag open. But certly for songbirds, it works just fine.
Is it true, by the way, that some animals like birds...
No.
If they're,
okay, I even know where you're going. I would love to tell everybody in the entire world, birds have essentially no sense of smell. They could not care less whether you touch their baby, to such an extent that if we get certain baby birds in and we know where there is a nest of the same kind of birds, same age, we can take that baby and plop it into a different nest. Parents don't care. They will feed whatever mouth opens in their nest.
Boy, that's sort of like when we have other kids come to our houses, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it
Friends,
is. An open
neighbors.
Mouth, you put food in it.
When animals are brought to Second Chance Wildlife Center or any rehabilitation center, then what happens? Now we have them in the towel, we have them in the bag, they're in the car, and we get there, and then what happens?
Well, in most instances, you should be given some kind of a form to fill out. Wildlife rehabilitators and rehab centers are required to keep certain information on every animal that comes in. We have to file both a state and a federal report every year. So you will be asked to fill out a form. You will notice that there are no financial responsibility forms given to you. The reason for that is it is against the law for a rehabilitator to charge for caring for that animal. And if we wanted to do it, we could not. We're not permitted to. So you'll be given a form. Depending upon the center, you may or may not see what is done to the animal. In many instances, a person will simply come out from a back room, relieve you of the animal, and disappear. And you won't ever see what goes on. What does go on, the animal is generally taken to an examination room, just as in your vet hospitals, where the staff, possibly even a staff veterinarian, depending on the size of the center, will examine the animal, try to figure out what the problems are, come up with a course of treatment, and then determine where best to house the animal while it's undergoing rehabilitation.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on kids and wildlife.
The excellent new book, Parents as Mentors, by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is a practical guide to bringing out the abilities in your child. Parents as Mentors is available at all bookstores.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. Today we are talking with Chris Montori about kids and wildlife. There's a wonderful story that I read in your newsletter about Frosty the squirrel. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, Frosty was one of my favorites, and this is the kind of situation we like to see. It's short, it's sweet, it has a happy ending. Frosty was a young squirrel, and this was during a very cold spell during the winter. He had somehow managed to slip down into a rain gutter on a house, dropped down to the bottom of it, couldn't climb back up, too slick, he couldn't get hold, and unfortunately he couldn't get out the bottom either because it was clogged with ice. And nobody really knows how long this squirrel was stuck in the downspout. The homeowner was out filling a bird feeder and thought she heard a little scratching sound. went to examine, check it all out, and discovered that there was certainly something in her rain gutter. Called for her daughter, who came out. They actually had to dismantle the downspout to get to this animal. Looked in, and here is this poor little squirrel, not only stuck, but literally frozen in the ice. And they could not simply dump him out. He was frozen in the ice. They tried pouring warm water on the outside of the drain. That wasn't doing it. They knew if they didn't do something quickly, the animal was going to die. Got out a dull knife and chipped the ice away to get him out of that pipe. Raced him over to our center, where we put him in a plastic bag up to his neck and immersed him in tepid water in our sink to start the warming process. He was so frozen, and he really was—he was essentially comatose. He was arching his back spasmodically, which is often a sign of impending death. And we really thought we did not have much of a chance with this animal. And we kept up the warm water bath for about 20 minutes. Took him out of that. The water was beginning to cool. Got a warm towel out of the dryer and started rubbing him down with that. At that point, he began to shiver. Shivering generally means you're cold, but in this case, it meant that he had warmed up enough that his body was again attempting to warm itself. That's what shivering does. It helps us warm up. He was still comatose, and there was no reaction from him, no fight, nothing. So we put him in our intensive care unit, which is a heated unit, kept him bundled up in the warm towel, and crossed our fingers. We went about our business for about an hour, 2 hours, went back to check. At that point, he was sitting up, took one look at us, started growling, banging at the door. It was a bit of a problem at that point to get him out of the unit because of the way it's designed. Managed to wrap him in that towel that I mentioned and get him into a bigger cage with food and water. We started him on antibiotics because of the possibility of pneumonia after that kind of chill, and we kept him for about 5 days. As soon as we finished the antibiotics, we called the people who brought him in. They came, they got him, they took him back where he came from, let him go. He didn't say thanks, but they had a lot of fun watching him because he ran up one tree after another into the neighbor's yard, up the trees in the neighbor's yard, back into their yard, and it clearly seemed very pleased to be back home.
What kinds of skills do volunteers have to learn to be able to help with injured animals?
Well, they need to feel very comfortable around animals. They need to learn how best to hold them. You have to love animals. But you have to be a cold realist at the same time. Some of these animals don't survive. There's nothing we can do, and despite our best efforts, some aren't going to survive. There are some people out there that cannot cope with that, and they just can't cope with the losses. It's too upsetting. People need to learn how to cope with rather disgusting things. Being in wildlife rehab is not a neat and tidy field, and you have to deal with all sorts of stuff. Now, if you want to really get into volunteering to a higher level, then you would also have to learn about various medications and how to calculate their dosages. You'd have to learn about nutritional requirements. Those kinds of things are more for people that actually are considering getting their own permits, doing this themselves. Your average volunteer, they just have to have a strong back and a willing heart, and they can learn on the job exactly what they need.
What about parents who say, hey, what a great community service opportunity for my kid?
We get a lot of that, too. We will accept kids 15 and up. We set that age specifically so we can accommodate some of the high schoolers. Younger than that, children really don't have the maturity, the judgment, or even the strength to do what needs to be done. I try to point out to parents who insist that their little Johnny or Jane just loves animals that helping at our center is almost as much fun as cleaning the cat box. It very quickly becomes not a real exciting thing to do. Once you've fed a baby bird a couple of times, the novelty wears off. It becomes pretty routine, and it's hard for kids to maintain a real high interest in it. It's hard for adults to maintain a high interest.
Now, what about Traveler?
Traveler was our first educational animal. Traveler was a possum, and she came in May of 96, I believe. Initially, we thought, well, there really wasn't anything wrong with her. Somebody picked her up because she just looked pretty young, and they were afraid she didn't have a mother and something had happened. As I watched her, though, I noticed that she kind of circled continually in her cage. That suggests some sort of brain injury. Because Traveler was a mammal, there is also, you know, maybe rabies. It's extremely unusual in possums, but not impossible. So we kept a close eye, and there was a kind of hands-off sign on her. And actually, we moved to our current location in June of 96, so she moved right along with us. And as with Blizzard, we discovered over a period of time that this animal showed virtually no fear, had no defensive postures. And most times, even with little baby possums, tiny little things, it's rather funny to watch. If you reach for them, they're open their mouth and they'll try and give some kind of a hiss, and they'll try to look very threatening so that you don't bother them. She never did that. And we found that she also was completely handleable. She was a wonderful animal, and she spent the next 3 years going with us to schools and scout camps and church groups and any place that wanted to talk. She was a wonderful education animal for children because possums are our only marsupials. It gave us a special opportunity to show people her very unique features.
You need to define marsupial.
A marsupial, for anyone who's not familiar with the term, is a pouched animal. Kangaroos are the ones that most people are familiar with. In North America, a possum is it. It's the only marsupial here. And Traveler, being female, did have a pouch, and we were able to hold her up and show everybody her pouch. They also have a prehensile tail. Most people think of monkeys that can hang on with their tails. That's a prehensile tail. And we were able to hold her and show children and anybody else how she could actually wrap her tail around your finger or your arm and could, in a pinch, hold herself that way. If we're going to dispel a few myths, no, possums do not hang around voluntarily by their tails. They do not have any kind of automatic gripping ability. If they were holding with their tails and they fell asleep, they'd fall to the ground. So they don't do that.
They don't sleep upside down hanging by their tails.
Aww. No, they do not. I know I'm shattering all sorts of illusions today. But they can hold on. They're excellent climbers. But possums can also have as many as 13 babies. And you can imagine if you've got 13 babies crawling around in your pouch or on your back, your balance might be off just a little bit. So that tail is a real handy safety feature. Should they misstep, they can actually catch themselves and save themselves from a fall. So she was wonderful. And unfortunately, a possum's lifespan is only about 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. And she was probably about 4 years old when she died.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on kids and wildlife.
For an audio cassette copy of any Parents Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. Today we are talking with Chris Montori about kids and wildlife. For children who are interested in learning more about wildlife, where are some good places that parents can look for to take them?
Well, I would certainly start with nature centers, and that's why they exist, is to help educate children about nature, and some of them have wonderful programs. Get on their mailing lists, because then you'll be notified of what's coming up. Different programs for all age groups. Go to the zoo and talk to the keepers at the zoo, learn about that. There are actually a few books on the subject. Many of them are horribly outdated. We as wildlife rehabilitators are very leery about publishing any kind of book that's like a how-to manual, because we don't want everybody trying to take care of wildlife. It's just too specialized a field, not to mention the fact that it's illegal unless you have permits. So if you find a self-help book, it's probably seriously out of date. There are a couple of books that parents can get. There is one that is written specifically for younger people. I have read through it, though, and it's not a bad one for adults either. It is called Healers of the Wild. It's written by Shannon K. Jacobs. Cost about $15. It is available through Wildlife Rescue League of Northern Virginia by calling their administrative phone line. That number is 703-391-8625.
You want to repeat that?
I'll repeat the number. It is okay. Area code 703-391-8625. For adults out there, there is another very helpful book. It's called Wild Neighbors, The Humane Approach to Living with Wildlife. This is actually published by the Humane Society of the United States, available for about $12.50. It's a great book. We have it at our center, and we use it all the time. This book deals with coping with wild neighbors that have maybe become a bit of a problem or that you're concerned about. Perhaps you've got a groundhog living under your porch. How do you either cope with it or discourage the groundhog without having to hurt it? This book tells you the dangers. You know, if there is a danger, health issues. Are you going to get sick because the groundhog is there? Is it going to actually cause some damage? It will explain all of that and then give suggestions on how to get it to move on without hurting it. And it covers all sorts of animals, saying foxes and raccoons and squirrels and just about anything that you can think of. And that's a good first step if you want to discourage certain animals from living in and around your yard.
Would you repeat the title of that book?
Yes, it's called Wild Neighbors, subtitled The Humane Approach to Living with Wildlife. It's published by Humane Society of the United States. It also is available from Wildlife Rescue of Northern Virginia at that same phone number.
Chris, does Second Chance Wildlife Center have a website?
Yes, we do have a website, and I'm glad you mentioned that because people often will turn to the internet for information and advice. It is a wonderful source. The problem is you don't know who you're getting information and advice from. So if you go there, I can recommend a couple of sites that you can check. One is International Wildlife Rehabilitation Council. And I believe their website is www.iwrc.org.
If you could repeat.
Yes, I ran that off pretty quick.
Yes.
www.iwrc.org. And the other one is National Wildlife Rehabilitators Association, which is www.nwra.org. These are two professional associations that were established specifically to help disseminate information among wildlife rehabilitators.
Okay. Can you do that website again also?
Yes. National Wildlife Rehabilitators Association website, www.nwra.org. Both of those, if you get information on either one of those websites, you can be reasonably certain that it is accurate information. Second Chance also has a website, and our address is www.scwc.org.
Okay, do you want to say that again?
Sure. Website address, simply our initials, easy to remember, www.scwc.org.
Well, thanks to Chris Montori, we're now not only wiser about handling animals in the wild, but we also are more appreciative of their lives and needs as well. Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Parents as Mentors. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And also tell us what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning in from. Parents as Mentors is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about us and our book Parents as Mentors, visit our website through our shortcut address, http://i.am/parentsperspective, all one word, and no W's, http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.